Hello and welcome back to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the April 6th to April 12th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, an image of China's president, Xi Jinping, sitting at an almost empty red table in front of a red background, wearing a red tie. The only thing on the table is a large button, which he seems to be pushing. The headline, China's Risky Reboot. The cover leader is China and the world economy, Xi Jinping's misguided plan to escape economic stagnation. It will disappoint China's people and anger the rest of the world. That will be followed by four additional leader articles, starting with Fool Me Once. Central banks have spent down their credibility. That will make inflation trickier to handle in the future. Then, nuclear deterrence. Beware a world without American power. Donald Trump's threat to dump allies would risk a nuclear free-for-all. Then, beware malware. A chilling near miss shows how today's digital infrastructure is vulnerable. This is how to protect the internet from malicious attacks. And then finally, culpable. That's two words. What Boeing, Disney, and others can learn from General Electric. GE's breakup holds lessons for Boeing, Disney, and others. Then we'll move to the Middle East and Africa section for World Central Kitchen. What Israel's killing of aid workers means for Gaza. It will make it even harder to feed desperate people. Then we'll move to the Europe section for a well-timed feud. Poles and Ukrainians are at loggerheads. That's good news for Putin. Farm exports and freight are the problems. And then finally, to the United States section for drug dependent. Joe Biden's assault on the $900 child eczema cream. What the Inflation Reduction Act means for the cost of health care. Back to the top now for the cover leader. China and the world economy. Xi Jinping's misguided plan to escape economic stagnation. It will disappoint China's people and anger the rest of the world. It is China's gravest economic test since the most far-reaching of Deng Xiaoping's reforms began in the 1990s. Last year, the country achieved growth of 5%, but the pillars of its decades-long miracle are wobbling. Its famously industrious workforce is shrinking. History's wildest property boom has turned to bust, and the global system of free trade that China used to get richer is disintegrating. President Xi Jinping's response is to double down on an audacious plan to remake China's economy. Blending techno-utopianism, central planning, and an obsession with security, this sets out China's ambition to dominate the industries of tomorrow. But its contradictions mean it will disappoint China's people and anger the rest of the world. Compared with 12 months ago, let alone the go-go years, the mood in China is dour. Although industrial production perked up in March, consumers are depressed, deflation lurks, and many entrepreneurs are disillusioned. Behind the angst lie deeper fears about China's vulnerabilities. It is forecast to lose 20% of its workforce by 2050. A crisis in the property industry, which drives a fifth of GDP, will take years to fix. It will hurt cash-strapped local governments that relied on land sales for revenues and flourishing real estate for growth. Relations with America are steadier, as a phone call between Mr. Xi and President Joe Biden this week attested, but they remain fragile. Chinese officials are convinced that America will restrict more Chinese imports and penalize more Chinese firms, whoever wins the White House in November. China's response is a strategy built around what officials call new productive forces. This eschews the conventional path of a big consumer stimulus to reflate the economy. That's the kind of ruse the decadent West resorts to. Instead, Mr. Xi wants state power to accelerate advanced manufacturing industries, which will in turn create high productivity jobs, make China self-sufficient, and secure it against American aggression. China will leapfrog steel and skyscrapers to a golden era of mass production of electric cars, batteries, biomanufacturing, and the drone-based low-altitude economy. The scope of this plan is breathtaking. We estimate annual investment in new productive forces has reached $1.6 trillion, a fifth of all investment and double what it was 5 years ago in nominal terms. This is equivalent to 43% of all business investment in America in 2023. Factory capacity in some industries could rise by over 75% by 2030. Some of this will be made by world-class firms keen to create value, but much will be prompted by subsidies and implicit or explicit state direction. Foreign companies are welcome, even though many have been burned in China before. Mr. Xi's ultimate aim is to invert the balance of power in the global economy. Not only will China escape dependence on Western technology, but it will control much of the key intellectual property in new industries and charge rents accordingly. Multinationals will come to China to learn, not teach. However, Mr. Xi's plan is fundamentally misguided. One flaw is that it neglects consumers. Although their spending dwarfs property and the new productive forces, it accounts for just 37% of GDP, much lower than global norms. To restore confidence amid the property slump and thereby boost consumer spending requires stimulus. To induce customers to save less requires better Social Security and health care, and reforms that open up public services to all urban migrants. Mr. Xi's reluctance to embrace this reflects his austere mindset. He detests the idea of bailing out speculative property firms or giving handouts to citizens. Young people should be less pampered and willing to, quote, eat bitterness, he said last year. Another flaw is that weak domestic demand means some new production will have to be exported. The world has, regrettably, moved on from the free trading 2000s, partly because of China's own mercantilism. America will surely block advanced imports from China or those made by Chinese firms elsewhere. Europe is in a panic about fleets of Chinese vehicles wiping out its car makers. Chinese officials say they can redirect exports to the global south. But if emerging countries' industrial development is undermined by a new China shock, they too will grow wary. China accounts for 31% of global manufacturing. In a protectionist age, how much higher can that figure go? The last flaw is Mr. Xi's unrealistic view of entrepreneurs, the dynamos of the past 30 years. Investment in politically favored industries is soaring, but the underlying mechanism of capital risk-taking has been damaged. Many bosses complain of Mr. Xi's unpredictable rulemaking and fear purges or even arrest. Relative stock market valuations are at a 25-year low. Foreign firms are wary. There are signs of capital flight and tycoons emigrating. Unless entrepreneurs are unshackled, innovation will suffer and resources will be wasted. China could become like Japan in the 1990s, trapped by deflation and a property crash. Worse, its lopsided growth model could wreck international trade. If so, that could ratchet geopolitical tensions even higher. America and its allies should not cheer that scenario. If China was stagnating and discontented, it could be even more bellicose than if it were thriving. If these flaws are obvious, why doesn't China change course? One reason is that Mr. Xi is not listening. For much of the past 30 years, China has been open to outside views on economic reform. Its technocrats studied global best practice and welcomed vigorous technical debates. Under Mr. Xi's centralizing rule, economic experts have been marginalized, and the feedback leaders used to receive has turned into flattery. The other reason Mr. Xi charges on is that national security now takes precedence over prosperity. China must be prepared for the struggle ahead with America, even if there is a price to pay. It is a profound change from the 1990s, and its ill effects will be felt in China and around the world. That was the cover leader, China and the World Economy, Xi Jinping's misguided plan to escape economic stagnation. It will disappoint China's people and anger the rest of the world. We'll move on now to our second leader article, Fool Me Once. Central banks have spent down their credibility. That will make inflation trickier to handle in future. Not long ago, the rich world was braced for a costly battle with inflation. Today, it can seem as if the war has been won bloodlessly. In most rich countries, annual core inflation, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, has fallen from peaks of 5 to 8% to a more tolerable 3 to 5%. In defiance of pessimistic economists, there has been no accompanying economic slump. Growth varies from booming, America, to respectable, Australia, Canada, Japan, to tepid, Britain, the euro area, but nowhere has it collapsed. In contrast to the disinflation of the 1980s, unemployment has stayed low. Has the world economy enjoyed salvation without sacrifice? Sadly, the answer is no. High inflation has left scars. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, the rich world enjoyed decades without any serious inflation problems. After ruthless monetary tightening in the 1980s, followed by a movement towards independent central banks targeting inflation, price surges seemed as outdated as shoulder pads. As firms and workers came to assume that inflation would stay low, they kept prices and wages in check. Their expectations thereby proved self-fulfilling. Unfortunately, the idea that inflation was dead also lodged in the minds of central bankers. When prices started to rise in 2021, they were horribly slow to respond. Eventually, they lifted interest rates much higher than they had initially thought necessary. Today, faster-than-expected disinflation has allowed them a sigh of relief. Last month, Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said that interest rate cuts were not far away, although he seemed more guarded in a speech on April 3rd. Andrew Bailey, governor of the Bank of England, has celebrated an, quote, increasingly positive story. But central bankers' problems are not over. Inflation remains above their targets. In Europe, it is likely to fall further, but only because the economy is weak. In America, getting inflation down to the Fed's 2% goal probably cannot be achieved at the current rate of economic growth, which is fueled in part by an unsustainable government deficit. Most important, the public is more attuned to the danger of inflation than it was before the pandemic. Some surveys show an uptick in long-run inflation expectations. Financial markets in America and Britain are charging a bit more for long-term inflation protection than they did. Predictions for future inflation have become more dispersed, meaning more people doubt whether inflation targets will be hit. In other words, now that high inflation is no longer a distant memory, the credibility of central banks looks fragile. It could shatter if another shock like the pandemic strikes. Inflation expectations rising definitively would cause inflation to persist until central banks brought about a painful slowdown. That was just about avoided this time, but further testing episodes are likely. geopolitical tensions, trade wars, climate change, and government's fondness for fiscal stimulus will all make inflation more volatile than it was in the sleepy decades after the 1980s. The risk is two-sided. Europe, especially, still faces the danger of inflation falling below the 2% target, owing to a weak economy. The combination of volatile inflation and diminished credibility means that the rich world's policymakers must be agile. They will need to adjust interest rates more quickly and to a greater extent when inflation fluctuates, and tolerate the resulting economic volatility. In so doing, they will come to look a bit like their colleagues in emerging markets. Without as long a record of low inflation behind them, central banks in Brazil, Chile, and Poland all raised interest rates sharply in 2021. All have since cut them as inflation has fallen. Move fast and forcefully. This is the rulebook that the likes of Mr. Powell and Mr. Bailey will have to follow. That was Fool Me Once. Central banks have spent down their credibility. That will make inflation trickier to handle in future. We'll turn now to nuclear deterrence. Beware a world without American power. Donald Trump's threat to dump allies would risk a nuclear free-for-all. Nuclear deterrence works, or at least it has so far. To understand how, look at the war in Ukraine. America and Europe arm their ally, but dare not deploy combat troops against Russia. In turn, Russia dares not strike at the West. Mutual terror ensures that nuclear powers do not attack each other overtly, just as it stopped the Cold War from turning hot, even though plenty of proxy conflicts raged. A sign of success is that only 9 countries have nuclear arms, far fewer than once feared, and fewer than the number of states able to make them. As NATO this week marks the 75th anniversary of the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty, thank the generosity of, quote, extended deterrence, by which America has sheltered European and Asian allies under its nuclear umbrella. It has done so in part to contain foes and in part to dissuade friends like Germany, Japan, and South Korea from going nuclear themselves. A return of Donald Trump as president threatens to sow chaos at a time when the world's nuclear balance is more unstable. His threat to let Russia, quote, do whatever the hell they want to NATO allies that spend too little on defense risks destroying the trust that makes extended deterrence possible. That could produce a nightmarish nuclear free-for-all that America has always sought to avert. As the world's first atomic power, America has long tried to stop others from going nuclear. Wonks call it the, quote, nth country problem. The more countries have nukes, the more others will want them, the likelier the risk of uncontrolled crises, the greater the constraints on American power, and the higher the danger that America itself will be nuked. Deterrence with 2 superpowers during the Cold War was scary enough. With ever more nuclear powers, it may become impossibly complex. America thus attempted to prevent nuclear proliferation by an often undeclared but far-reaching strategy of inhibition, based on 3 pillars. Norms and treaties, such as the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968, coercion of friends and foes by diplomacy, sanctions, and threats of military action, and reassurance through military alliances and security guarantees. Extended deterrence is counterintuitive, in that America risks the homeland for the sake of allies. The promise, firm enough to deter the Kremlin, has always been plagued by some doubt. To strengthen it, America has deployed troops and nuclear weapons in Europe and has given allies a role in nuclear missions. Winston Churchill is said to have quipped that all he needed to defend Europe was one American soldier, preferably dead. Mr. Trump, neck and neck with President Joe Biden in the polls, according to our tracker, sees allies as a burden, not an asset. His contempt mattered less in his first term, when the world was quiet, for which he likes to take credit. Now America is deeply involved in wars in Ukraine and Gaza, and clouds are gathering over Taiwan. A nuclear race looms as Russia issues threats and China builds up its nuclear arsenal. Nobody knows quite what Mr. Trump would do. Even he may not be sure, despite his bluster about ending the war in Ukraine in a day. But his comments, former advisors' accounts of his desire to leave NATO, and harebrained proposals by putative future ones, all point to a reduction or abandonment of American security guarantees to NATO, and so to allies generally. Congressional Republicans' months-long blocking of a bill to provide aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan is a bad omen. Allies will hope that, as in Mr. Trump's first term, conventionally minded members of his administration will somehow help limit the damage. But some Trump world figures say that NATO countries which do not spend 2% of GDP on defense should not be protected by the pledge that an attack on one ally is an attack on all. Others propose a dormant NATO, in which America withdraws ground forces from Europe while preserving the nuclear umbrella. Such ideas are nonsense. America cannot defend the martial east of Europe without protecting supply lines through the laggardly west. And would Mr. Trump risk a nuclear attack on American soil to help Europeans whom he would not defend conventionally? European governments are thinking the unthinkable. Poland's foreign minister, Radoslaw Sikorski, warns that a failure to keep arming Ukraine could push allies into, quote, their own nuclear weapons programs. Politicians from Germany to South Korea have said similar things. Others talk of Europeanizing NATO and substituting Britain's and France's nuclear weapons for American ones, though their combined stockpiles are less than a tenth of Russia's and their doctrines for protecting the rest of Europe still embryonic. European allies are preparing to take up more of the burden of helping Ukraine, hoping to Trump-proof themselves. None of this can substitute for credible American deterrence. A world without American power endangers America for two reasons. Because foes like Russia and China will feel emboldened, and because friends will lose faith in their old ally. America first isolationism, far from insulating the country, will only magnify the nuclear risks America faces. That was Nuclear Deterrence. Beware a world without American power. Donald Trump's threat to dump allies would risk a nuclear free-for-all. We'll turn now to leader number four. Beware malware. A chilling near miss shows how today's digital infrastructure is vulnerable. This is how to protect the internet from malicious attacks. Few inventions in history have been as important for human civilization and as poorly understood as the internet. It developed not as a centrally planned system, but as a patchwork of devices and networks connected by makeshift interfaces. Decentralization makes it possible to run such a complex system, but every so often comes a chilling reminder that the whole edifice is uncomfortably precarious. On March 29th, a lone security researcher announced that he had discovered, largely by chance, a secret back door in XZ Utils. This obscure but vital piece of software is incorporated into the Linux operating systems that control the world's internet servers. Had the backdoor not been spotted in time, everything from critical national infrastructure to the website hosting your cat pictures would have been vulnerable. The backdoor was implanted by an anonymous contributor who had won the trust of other coders by making helpful contributions for over 2 years. That patience and diligence bears the fingerprints of a state intelligence agency. Such large-scale supply chain attacks, which target not individual devices or networks, but the underlying software and hardware that they rely on, are becoming more frequent. In 2019 to 2020, the SVR, Russia's foreign intelligence agency, penetrated American government networks by compromising a network management platform called SolarWinds Orion. More recently, Chinese state hackers modified the firmware of Cisco routers to gain access to economic, commercial, and military targets in America and Japan. The internet is inherently vulnerable to schemes like the XZ Utils backdoor. Like so much else that it relies on, this program is open source, which means that its code is publicly available. Rather like Wikipedia. Changes to it can be suggested by anyone. The people who maintain open source code often do so in their spare time. A headline from 2014, after the uncovering of a catastrophic vulnerability in OpenSSL, a tool widely used for secure communication, and which had a budget of just $2,000, captured the absurdity of the situation. The internet is being protected by two guys named Steve. Let me just disclose at this point that I'm not one of them. Continuing, it is tempting to assume that the solution lies in establishing central control, either by states or companies. In fact, history suggests that closed-source software is no more secure than is the open-source type. Only this week, America's Cyber Safety Review Board, a federal body, rebuked Microsoft for woeful security standards that allowed Russia to steal a signing key, the cryptographic equivalent of crown jewels for any cloud service provider. This gave it sweeping access to data. By comparison, open source software holds many advantages because it allows for collective scrutiny and accountability. The way forward, therefore, is to make the most of open source, while easing the huge burden it places on a small number of unpaid, often harried individuals. Technology can help too. Let's Encrypt, a nonprofit, has made the internet safer over the past decade by using clever software to make it simple to encrypt users' connections to websites. More advanced artificial intelligence might eventually be able to spot anomalies in millions of lines of code at a stroke. Other fixes are regulatory. America's Cyber Strategy, published last year, makes clear that the responsibility for failures should lie not with open source developers, but, quote, the stakeholders most capable of taking action to prevent bad outcomes. In practice, that means governments and tech giants, both of which benefit enormously from free software libraries. Both should expand funding for and cooperation with nonprofit institutions like the Open Source Initiative and the Linux Foundation, which support the open source ecosystem. The New Responsibility Foundation, a German think tank, suggests that governments might, for example, allow employees to contribute to open source software in their spare time and ease laws that criminalize white hat or ethical hacking. They should act quickly. The XZ Utils backdoor is thought to be the first publicly discovered supply chain attack against a crucial piece of open source software. But that does not mean it was the first attempt, nor is it likely to be the last. That was Leader Article number 4, Beware Malware, A chilling near miss shows how today's digital infrastructure is vulnerable. This is how to protect the internet from malicious attacks. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, this program featuring articles from the April 6th to April 12th edition of the magazine. We'll return now to hear leader article number 5, the last leader article for this program, culpable. Again, that's two words. What Boeing, Disney, and others can learn from General Electric. GE's breakup holds lessons for Boeing, Disney, and others. Only rarely are chief executives appointed with a mandate for dismemberment. Yet, when Larry Culp assumed the top job at General Electric, GE, in October 2018, he was expected to sell parts of the 130-year-old conglomerate at a pace even faster than his empire-building predecessors had assembled them. In November 2021, he announced a radical finale, splitting the firm in three. GE's healthcare business became a separate company last year. On April 2nd, its power division went the same way, leaving behind GE Aerospace, the firm's engine-making operation. Investors are reaping the rewards. After dithering during the first 4 years of Mr. Culp's tenure, GE's shares have been on a jet-fueled tear. The cumulative stock market value of GE's three successor firms is $237 billion. Although that is well below the firm's peak of $594 billion in 2000, it is more than double what Mr. Culp inherited. Business school students have spent decades dissecting the hubristic acquisitions that defined GE's life. Now they must heed the lessons from its final act. The fact that the wind is at GE's back has undoubtedly helped. Demand for jet engines has picked up since the COVID-19 pandemic ended, and clean energy projects are benefiting from government handouts in America. The bullish mood of America's stock market has certainly eased the separation process, too. But Mr. Culp also deserves praise. His tenure reflects not just a victory of focus over sprawl, but also of operational excellence at a firm that long suffered the effects of excessive financial engineering. One advantage is that Mr. Culp was an outsider, the first ever to take the helm at GE. The turnaround probably could not have been pulled off by a lifer. GE insiders had ossified. Nothing had replaced Six Sigma, a system used to reduce manufacturing errors that was championed by Jack Welch, the firm's acquisitive boss, who retired as long ago as 2001. Mr. Culp brought his own Japanese-style management philosophy. The fresh but fanatical approach to contentious operational improvement helped usher in cultural change. So did getting executives onto the factory floor. The new thinking meant that GE's assets did not languish on the chopping block, but improved on Mr. Culp's watch and stopped the breakup becoming a fire sale. The program has a familiar taste for fanciful names. The power business has been christened GE Vernova. But the markets are cheering on GE's heirs, which is striking given that spin-offs often disappoint investors. IBM's infrastructure services business, Kyndryl, and Johnson & Johnson's consumer healthcare operation, Kenvue, have both failed to shine in the public markets. Mr. Culp's success, then, is vindication for smooth operators, not firms looking to ditch problem assets or activist hedge funds in search of conglomerate discounts. Bosses preparing to lop off divisions of their own firms, including those at Unilever, will study him closely. But there are broader lessons, too. Disney, which recently prevailed in a proxy fight against Nelson Peltz, a noisy shareholder who once lobbied for change at GE, is just one American blue-chip firm that might find benefit from fresh thinking. The lessons may be most apt for Boeing, a case study for rotten corporate culture. In March, its boss resigned 2 months after the blowout of a fuselage panel in one of its 737 MAX planes. Some have suggested Mr. Culp for the job, which would be a severe test of his operational prowess. In March, Boeing confirmed that it was in discussions to acquire Spirit AeroSystems, an unsatisfactory supplier it had previously spun off. Mr. Culp says he is happy running GE Aerospace, one of Boeing's suppliers. But if he can manage a business well while pulling it apart, perhaps he could also thrive at putting one back together again. That was the final Leader article, Culpable: What Boeing, Disney, and Others Can Learn from General Electric. GE's breakup holds lessons for Boeing, Disney, and others. We move now to the Middle East and Africa section for World Central Kitchen: What Israel's Killing of Aid Workers Means for Gaza. It will make it even harder to feed desperate people. The road was dangerous, but they took precautions. On April 1st, a group of aid workers left a warehouse in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. The vehicles in their three-car convoy were clearly marked with the frying pan logo of World Central Kitchen, or WCK, a charity that has worked closely with Israel. Their route along the coastal road had been cleared with the Israeli army. But the precautions did not help. An Israeli drone, loitering overhead, fired three missiles at the cars, one after another, killing all seven people inside. They are thought to be the first foreign aid workers to die in the six-month Gaza war. Around 200 of their Palestinian colleagues have been killed. Beyond the human tragedy, their deaths will have bigger consequences for Israel's diplomatic standing and for hungry Gazans. Most of the victims come from Western countries that support Israel. All are now furious. Britain summoned the Israeli ambassador for a rare demarche, and Rishi Sunak, the prime minister, told Benjamin Netanyahu he was appalled. The United Arab Emirates, the main funder of WCK's work in Gaza, accused Israel occupation forces of targeting the aid workers, unusually strong language from Israel's closest Arab ally. Joe Biden, who calls Jose Andres, the chef who founded WCK, a friend, said he was outraged by the killings. "Israel has not done enough to protect aid workers," he said. The deaths will almost certainly lead to greater domestic pressure on such governments when it comes to arms sales to Israel. Whether they lead to a shift, in a way that 33,000 Palestinian deaths have not, is less clear. Isaac Herzog, the Israeli president, called Mr. Andres and expressed deep sorrow. The army chief pledged a thorough investigation, though Israel has a poor track record of those. Israel's prime minister was less contrite. In a bizarre videotaped statement, a smiling Mr. Netanyahu said that he was recovering well from hernia surgery and then acknowledged the tragic event in Gaza. "This happens in war," he said. The UN says that half of Gaza's 2.2 million people face catastrophic food insecurity, and that hundreds of thousands of people in northern Gaza are on the brink of famine. Yet Israel has tried to sideline the UN Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, the main aid distributor in Gaza. Instead, Israel has sought to work through NGOs. It was enthusiastic about WCK. Last month, it allowed the group to start shipping aid to Gaza by sea. The first time in two decades it has loosened its maritime embargo of the territory. After the drone strike, though, WCK said it was pausing its operations in Gaza and turned back ships en route from Cyprus. Other NGOs followed suit. Aid workers are willing to accept risk. That is part of the job. But the risks seem too high in Gaza. Parts of the enclave have fallen into anarchy, and Israeli commanders show scant regard for protecting civilians. The effort to bring enough food into Gaza has been haphazard and deadly. Pallets airdropped by Western and Arab forces have struck and killed civilians. Hungry Gazans have attacked lorries and been crushed in stampedes at food deliveries. America is trying to build a pier to receive bigger shipments of aid, but the project is still weeks away from completion, and there are big questions around who will secure the pier and deliver the supplies. For months, Mr. Netanyahu has refused to order the Israeli army to distribute aid in Gaza itself. But if Israel does not want UNRWA involved, and if other groups do not feel safe, it will have no choice. That was an article from the Middle East and Africa section, World Central Kitchen, What Israel's Killing of Aid Workers Means for Gaza. It will make it even harder to feed desperate people. And we'll move now to the Europe section for A Well-Timed Feud. Poles and Ukrainians are at loggerheads. That's good news for Putin. Farm exports and freight are the problems. Flashing blue lights shield protesting Polish farmers from the 10 kilometers long line of Ukrainian lorries they are holding up at the Ruben-Rava-Ruska border crossing. The drivers say they would waste little time in moving the protesters aside were the police not there. Huddled around a barrel fire, the farmers say they are only protecting their economic future. They do not want to be undercut by so-called underregulated Ukrainian grain. The drivers, some of whom have been waiting in freezing weather for weeks, ask what that has to do with the lorries carrying goods and humanitarian aid into Ukraine, which are being held up also. No one has an answer. The border demonstrations, now 5 months old, have economic roots. At the start of the war, when Ukraine lost access to its deep water ports in the Black Sea, the EU temporarily exempted Ukrainian lorry drivers from a permit system that restricts movement in and out of the bloc. That upset Polish drivers, who had dominated the local freight business. Meanwhile, a suspension of import duties and quotas on Ukrainian farm goods, produced by larger, more efficient outfits, posed competition to small Polish farmsteads, already pinched by EU environmental laws. A slump in world grain prices, plus politicking ahead of Polish local elections in April, heightened the tension. The protests have cost Ukraine hundreds of millions of dollars in lost farm and freight business. It is worse for the drivers waiting at Ruben. Before the protests, they were making 5 trips a month. Now they are lucky to make 1. Strict quotas decide who gets through. At the Ruben crossing, it is 1 lorry an hour, or 4 for perishable or humanitarian goods. The farmers' protests are fertile ground for Russia to influence Poles with misgivings about Ukraine's potential accession to the EU, when its drivers and exporters will face no limits at all. An investigation showed that one of the protesters appeared to be connected to the Russian embassy in Warsaw. One protest banner appealed to Mr. Putin to, quote, restore order, an unlikely message in Poland, but one that generated a lot of media heat. There may be links between Russia and some members of Poland's hard-right Confederation Party, which played a role in the earlier protests. Andrzej Czerniak, a spokesman for Ukraine's military intelligence agency, says the Kremlin is trying to work on whatever level it can. "We see it very clearly and we follow it. We doff our hats to them, to be honest. It's impressive work." One Ukrainian military researcher says Russia is stepping up its media influence ambitions. The internet has provided new opportunities to penetrate public opinion at a fraction of the previous cost. The researcher says a recent Ukrainian exercise found 18,000 suspicious Facebook pages promoting fake narratives about the Polish protests, for example, exaggerating Ukrainian corruption. An analysis by Antibot for Navalny, an activist group that tracks Doppelganger, the Kremlin's social media influence network, tells a similar tale. A network of approximately 10,000 bots retweeted a fake news story about the Polish protest seen by 50,000 users. Many Doppelganger stories exaggerated tension between Ukrainians and their neighbors. The impact of these operations is less clear. Colonel Taras Dzuba of the Ukrainian Army's Strategic Communication Department says the Russians play a long game. "They rarely achieve results immediately, but wear down people's defenses so they become willing to hear new sources of information." Intense negotiations at the EU level offer hope of resolving the border problem. Krzysztof Paszczyk, parliamentary leader of the Polish People's Party, part of the governing coalition, says Ukraine and Poland are close to a compromise on agricultural imports that would appease the farmers and let the EU reach an agreement to extend duty-free trade with Ukraine. In any event, the protest has damaged the country's relations. At the start of the war, Poland and Ukraine were united as blood brothers against a common enemy. The Poles took in refugees and slipped MiG fighter jets over the border, disguising them as spare parts. Now, many Poles see Ukraine as a corrupt or even dangerous competitor. Many Ukrainians see Poles as impeding their survival. Confusion and distrust reign. And even if the idea that Russia has had a hand is exaggerated, it has poisoned the well further. That was an article from the Europe section, a well-timed feud. Poles and Ukrainians are at loggerheads. That's good news for Putin. Farm exports and freight are the problems. And we'll turn now to the United States section for drug-dependent. Joe Biden's assault on the $900 child eczema cream. What the Inflation Reduction Act means for the cost of health care. Buying prescription drugs in America can feel a bit like being a tourist haggling at a street market. First, a ludicrous retail price is mentioned. For your correspondent recently, $902 for eczema cream for a child. Then insurance is applied, followed by a layering on of coupons, often printed by the pharmacist and then handed to themselves, discount cards, and rebate claims. And yet, even after all that, the amount of cash you pay out of pocket is still steep by international standards. The cream ended up costing $273. Americans agree on few things, but lowering the price they pay for medication is the most popular policy position in American politics, tied with support for Social Security. 9 in 10 say this should be an important or top priority for Congress. In his State of the Union message, Joe Biden spent a full 3 minutes on the topic. Yet only 1 in 4 say they are aware of his attempts through the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, of 2022, to reduce prices. This is something he needs to rectify. At least as interesting as the direct impact of the law is the question of what the indirect ones might be. Americans spend twice as much on prescription medication per person as comparable countries, according to Peterson KFF, a health research group. This spending is skewed by branded drugs with no competitors, so-called non-generic drugs. These make up 10% of prescription drugs, but 80% of spending. Adjusted for inflation, spending on prescription drugs has increased from $101 per person in 1960 to $1,147 in 2021. The IRA, which was mainly a climate change and industrial policy law, did actually have some provisions designed to bring down prices, although not in the short term. One politically important one relates to Medicare, the public health insurer for the elderly, which covers prescription drugs for 50 million people. The IRA empowered Medicare administrators to negotiate with, or maybe dictate to, drug makers, which they had long been forbidden to do. This should eventually reduce the price consumers pay. In the near term, the IRA also capped some out-of-pocket drug costs. The first to feel the effects of these measures are people with diabetes who need insulin, a drug for which Americans pay several times what Europeans pay. A national out-of-pocket cap of $35 per insulin prescription per month has meant that, since 2023, millions enrolled in Medicare now pay less. Another tangible result is an annual cap on out-of-pocket spending. Doug Hart, a 77-year-old from Arizona with heart disease, previously spent about $7,000 per year on prescription medication. Under the new cap, which is being phased in, he will be on the hook for only the first $3,300 this year before Medicare foots the rest of the bill. From next year, the cap will be lowered to $2,000. The way I see it, Biden is saving me $5,000 in out-of-pocket drug costs, and I can go and see my grandkids in Chicago instead, he says. These measures have been relatively easy to implement because, if anything, the pharma industry welcomes them. They make drugs cheaper for consumers while the government picks up the difference. But Mr. Biden's law also gives Medicare a mandate to negotiate drug prices directly with manufacturers and penalizes those that raise prices above inflation. This has met with more hostility from the industry, which argues that it will crimp innovation. Yet it is this part that will make a difference for taxpayers. Without it, the price caps for consumers will just push high drug bills on to the government. Mr. Biden's claim that he has already saved American taxpayers $160 billion thanks to these negotiations is misleading, because it relies on projections of future government savings. Negotiations between the government and Big Pharma are underway behind closed doors. Drug companies are keen to reassure shareholders that the government's proposals are not as outlandish as feared. Yet, at the same time, they have filed several lawsuits challenging the legislation. One way or another, the federal agency that administers Medicare will publish a list of the, quote, maximum fair price for each of the first 10 negotiated drugs by this September, with the intention of introducing these discounts by 2026. Medicare spending on these 10 drugs more than doubled between 2018 and 2022. There is also the question of what the knock-on effects of the IRA will be. Mr. Biden has said he will try both to increase the number of drugs subject to negotiation and expand the $2,000 out-of-pocket cap to people with private insurance. Once the prices that Medicare pays for expensive drugs are published, this might increase the bargaining power of private insurers, too. Now that the government has these new tools, there are huge opportunities to go beyond the IRA, says Richard Frank of the Brookings Institution, a think tank. If you can suddenly negotiate more drug prices earlier in their life cycle, or these prices apply to the entire private market, then suddenly this is not an incremental change. This is a sea change, says Benedict Ippolito at AEI, another think tank. The president's campaign team will be hoping that enough people notice the new reduced Medicare drug prices in September, just in time for the election. But another scenario is just as likely. Mr. Trump wins and claims credit for Mr. Biden's achievement because the price reductions would not actually come into force until 2026. That would be the Trumpiest move. Either way, patients should benefit. That was an article from the United States section, Drug Dependent, Joe Biden's Assault on the $900 Child Eczema Cream. What the Inflation Reduction Act means for the cost of health care. And that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the April 6th to April 12th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veach, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other SunSounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio.